all need to make sure that they realize that we're not silenced, and we are in the majority, and our voices need to be heard every single day. And this is just the beginning. This rally is just the beginning. We're not going to be silenced. For 4 years, this is what they're going to face every day. We may not be here in person, but we are in our homes, and we are in our schools, and we are at our work, and we believe the same thing, and that won't be silenced.
That's Sandy Tol Sepanuk at the Women's March in Los Angeles on Saturday. More than 500,000 people showed up in downtown LA. Organizers were expecting just 80,000. Worldwide, at least 3.6 million people marched. And the protest sign game was on point. For example, I've seen sturdier cabinets at IKEA. So bad, even introverts are here. We shall overcome. And another slogan we've become familiar with, si se puede, yes we can, in Spanish. Well, the woman who coined that phrase was at a women's march in Park City at the Sundance Film Festival because a documentary about her premiered there over the weekend.
Come on up, brothers, we are waiting for you!
Dolores Huerta helped lead a worldwide grape boycott that forced growers to agree to some of the country's first farm worker contracts.
Dolores Huerta co-founded the farm workers' rights movement along with Cesar Chavez back in the 1960s. That movement won basic rights for farm workers, clean drinking water, mandatory breaks, protective clothing against pesticide exposure. One of its most famous and effective tactics was a nationwide grape boycott. The new documentary about Dolores Huerta is called Dolores. I caught up with her at Sundance this weekend, a day after she had spoken at the Women's March.
How are you doing this morning?
I am great. How are you?
And I asked her where the protest should go from here.
Dolores, I want to talk to you first about the Women's March on Saturday and where you see this protest movement going forward.
Well, I think it's just going to be so awesome. If we go back into the time of Nixon and California Governor Reagan, you know, we saw pretty much the same situation that existed then with the divisions in the country about the Vietnam War. And you saw that all of the movements were pretty much just starting to really blossom and grow. The women's movement, the green movement was just beginning, the LGBT movement, civil rights movement, the workers' movement, and Latino Chicano movement was just starting then. And so then, you know, if we fast forward to what's happening right now, and we see this incredible response. I remember when we did the counter protest for the Nixon inauguration, and I was in New York City at the time working on the Great Boycott, and we had the Yippies. Remember the Yippies?
Abby Hoffman,
and we all came together, and we had a march in Washington, and we inaugurated a pig. And we gave them grapes as the inauguration dinner because we were boycotting grapes at the time. I mean, how many people were on that march? I would say maybe 1,000, a possible, maybe a little bit more. So to compare that with what's happening today, I mean, it's just no comparison in many ways. And so I believe that all of the protest movements that are happening right now, the organization that is happening right now, it's really going to be a part of the healing that we need in the United States of America. But the main thing is that people are taking responsibility. You know, they're saying, this is my country, these are my values, these are the things that I'm going to fight for. And so hopefully that will all transfer into the electoral politics so that we can see that people will start understanding. And these were my words at the march, by the way, that we have to go back into our communities. We have to organize. But we have to remember that this is a democracy. And the way that things work is that you have to vote and you have to get elected. And so this is the way that you take power in a democracy. So hopefully that out of all of this marches and the movements, that people will understand you've got to take it to the next level. You've got to take it to the voting level. You've got to take it, you know, to understand that you have to run, you have to become a candidate, you've got to field progressive candidates. If not, you know, it's not going to change.
How do you maintain your optimism when you look at what's happening right now with the talk about deporting immigrants, the very harsh negative talk that is sometimes coming out of Washington? You have spent your entire life working for immigrant rights, and how do you maintain your optimism when you see the tenor of the country and how people seem to be feeling about immigrants and undocumented immigrants.
Well, I think the one good thing about living a long time is that you can look back and you can see where, you know, these obstacles have been there in the past, but by, you know, they have been overcome eventually, and sometimes it takes a lot of time to make it happen. And so you just have to I always sometimes think that when things happen the way that we don't want them to happen, when these great obstacles are put in our way, it just means that we have to do more organizing. There's more work that has to be done. And we know that there's a lot of fear in the immigrant community about what's going on right now and the threats that President Trump has aimed at the Latino community, at the immigrant community. But that also means that the Latino community has to come together. And we see that this is happening right now. You see a lot of professionals that are stepping up. They're saying, okay, how could we come together and organize and support our undocumented community? So I think that out of all of this chaos, there will be a lot of organizing and a lot of growth. A lot of new leaders will sprout up because this is what has to happen.
Well, is one of the failures that there hasn't been that kind of leadership since, you know, you and Cesar Chavez no longer leading the United Farm Workers. Where is that leadership for the Latino community?
Well, I don't agree with that. I think if we see, for instance, the Dreamers, the young immigrants, the undocumented, when they were able to get the most powerful person in the world, Barack Obama, to declare an executive action that they could stay here, they could study, they could go to school here. But they are the ones that did the work. They were the ones that were out there in front making that happen. So we have a lot of leaders in different communities. I think the one thing is that we just have to, the movement has to expand, and we've got to get more people involved, and there will be more leaders that will come out of this, because leadership comes out of struggle, and it comes out of doing the work to make the changes, and they are out there, and I think our job is to make sure that we can reach out to them and inspire them and, say, yeah, this is the way we do it. We just have to get out there and do the organizing, do the work.
Are you still doing the work?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. My organization, the Dolores Huerta Foundation, that's exactly what we do. We raise money, we hire organizers, we train them, and we send them into communities and go out there and meet with people and tell them that they have the power to make the changes. And they can't wait for anybody to do it for them. They are the ones that have to improve their lives and their community, because if they sit around and wait for somebody to make it happen, it's not going to happen.
Dolores Huerta and Cesar Chavez created the farm workers' rights movement together. She's 86 years old now, a grand dam in the progressive protest movement. But she is not the household name Cesar Chavez is.
One of the interesting aspects of this, which I guess I hadn't been aware of, was the fact that you didn't really get the credit during the time that you were due when you were leading the United Farm Workers, that it was all about Cesar Chavez, and no one outside the movement, very few people outside the movement, really knew who you were and gave you credit for that. And I wonder if you could talk about that.
Well, And I have to take some of the responsibility for that because being so focused on farm workers and their conditions and their poverty and the fact that we needed to change that, you might say I was kind of blinded in many ways. And it wasn't until later on in the movement that I had the realization, especially after coming back from New York City, working with Gloria Steinem, working with Eleanor Smeal, the head of the Feminist Majority. They invited me to be on the board of the Feminist Majority. And that really helped me a lot to, understand that, hey, we have to fight for women's rights also. It's not just enough to fight, for our people, so to speak. And this is true of many of the women in the civil rights movement back in the 60s and the 70s. We were so busy fighting for our ethnic group that we forgot about our women. And women were very marginalized. Even on the Great March on Washington, when Dr. King gave that great speech, I found out later that they really didn't want any women on that platform, And so when Cesar and I started the union, we started together, and he said to me, one of us has to be the spokespersons for the organization. And he said, I think it should be me. And I said, oh, of course, Cesar. Now, I'm saying, looking back, if I would have put my feminist lens on, I would have said, it's great. We'll just, we'll do it equally. Sometimes you'll be the spokesperson and sometimes I'll be the spokesperson. But I think that as myself, like many, many women, we always felt that we shouldn't be taking credit for our work. And I think it was Gloria Steinem that finally said, no, we've got to do this, you know. And I kind of quote one of her books that she wrote about the revolutionary women, about you have to take credit, you have to put lights out there. And, of course, when women do that, they get criticized, okay, you know, because she's being egotistical, she's being conceited. And so we grew up with that myth. And so we're handicapped right at the beginning. We're handicapped, you know. And so we have to then, for the rest of our lives, we have to kind of get out of that myth, fight our way out of that, to understand that, no, we as women can stand up on our own two feet.
That's Dolores Huerta, co-founder of the United Farm Workers Union. The documentary Dolores premiered at Sundance this weekend. Well, right after the march ended in Washington on Saturday, some of the leaders got together at a kind of town hall session they called Where We Go From Here. Ai-Jen Poo is director of the National Domestic Workers Alliance, one of the many groups that sponsored the march, and she was at that meeting. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Great to be with you.
Great to have you. Also joining us, Abby Johnson, the founder of the anti-abortion group And Then There Were None. She was also at the march on Saturday. Welcome to you.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Well, Ai-Jen, let's begin with you. So where do you go from here? What was discussed at that town hall session?
Well, obviously we saw a huge show of force on Saturday, and there's lots to do going forward to continue building the momentum and building the movement. We talked about the need to build community and organize locally. We talked about the need to take action to protect the policies and the communities that we care about. And there are a number of threats already on our health care, on immigrant communities. So really being in motion every single day on all of those fronts. And then we talked about the need to start preparing for 2018. The next big political moment in this country is just around the corner. And we have the potential with this march to actually build a wave of political power and victories throughout every level of government, local, state, federal elections in 2018, to send a really strong message, potentially elect thousands of women to office, and set the stage for 2020.
Okay, so you have a lot on your list, a big agenda. And Abby Johnson, let me turn to you. Your group was originally one of the partners in the march, I understand. Is that right?
Correct. Mm-hmm.
And then that didn't happen.
Right, and we were removed.
You were removed because you're anti-abortion?
Yes.
But you went to the march anyway.
We did, yeah. We had planned on going to the march, and we're certainly concerned about other issues besides abortion that affect women, and so we wanted to go and join with other women and unite with women on common issues that are concerning for us.
What are those issues?
Well, I mean, I'm concerned about domestic violence. I'm concerned about pay inequality. I'm concerned about breastfeeding rights for women. I can't believe in 2017 we're still having women being kicked out of public establishments for breastfeeding their children. I'm concerned about sex trafficking. I'm concerned at the lack of female politicians and hope that will increase. So, and there's a lot of things that are common among the women that were there and the groups that were represented. Abortion is just one thing that we disagree on, but I believe that we certainly agree on more than what we disagree.
So did you feel welcomed at the march and welcome in the conversation going forward?
I did. I mean, we had, you know, people come up to us. We had a lot of women come up to us and say, hey, we're so glad you're here. You know, we're pro-life as well, but that's not why they were there. Maybe they were union workers there for domestic violence issues or immigration. We had women come up to us and say, hey, I don't agree with your stance on abortion, but I'm so thankful that you're here, which was really encouraging. So I think that we live in such a, I don't know, contentious time right now, and there's not a lot of dialogue. And I think that dialogue is really important moving forward.
And what have you been hearing from other conservative women, maybe women who didn't attend the march, in terms of what they want to do with these issues and with their own political activism?
Well, I mean, I think certainly there are a lot of women that didn't really understand why we would want to be there. But I think it's hard for a lot of people to recognize that there are a whole lot of issues affecting women besides, you know, abortion rights. And we need to come together on those issues and stand united. But I think that for the most part, I think a lot of conservative women felt like they weren't welcome there, and like people didn't want them to be a part of the conversation. But, you know, I'm at the table with abortion activists on a regular basis, and I find that there's a whole lot more that we have in common that we don't have in common. And so I think it's important for us to move forward on those points.
And Ijen, I want you to react to that because, you know, this march, while it was massive and it was, you know, unprecedented probably in terms of its size in the United States and in the world in terms of how many people marched, it has been tagged as a liberal movement by and large. And I'm wondering how, as you organize politically, you attempt to broaden the tent to include women of different political persuasions.
Well, I think at its core, the vision is really a vision for a healthy multiracial democracy for the 21st century. And there's a lot of values that we all share, and I think part of a healthy democracy is one where there can be disagreement and debate over issues. And so, you know, I think that that is part and parcel to how we become the democracy that, you know, how we realize our promise. And I do believe that this march was established as a space for us to practice that democracy, to continue to expand it, and the movement needs to be inclusive, absolutely. There are so many women out there from all walks of life, rural communities, all different kinds of communities that are struggling with lots of different kinds of issues. And we want to be able to include their voices and their participation in this movement, absolutely.
And then is it also important to have a focus, a singular focus, be it the 2018 midterm elections or be it some other issue, you know, women-specific issue, I don't know, in order to sort of focus the attention on the part of the participants? Or, I mean, as you say, there are lots of platforms, lots of things you discussed in your meeting after the march, and there are certainly lots of organizations involved across the spectrum of issues. Is it more important to be inclusive or to be focused?
I think it's a false choice in many ways. I think that through the course of a woman's life, we actually deal with all kinds of different issues, and we often deal with them at the same time. And when we live our lives as whole human beings, we don't experience one as more important or to the exclusion of others. And I think when you talk to people about their stories and their actual experiences, it becomes clear that it's a false choice between many of the different issues that were being raised in the course of the march and will continue to be raised through this administration. I call it whole person politics, but I really do believe in an agenda that's inclusive of our entire experiences, where we're not forced to make false choices. And we can actually move, and I believe it's actually a formula for more power. Because on any number of these issues that we all care about, when we work in isolation and in silos around those issues, we rarely are able to have a powerful enough voice to actually make any change. And so we do need to figure out how we connect, how we work together, and we think more holistically about values, about agenda, about human dignity, about our freedoms in a way that actually lifts the whole.
Okay, so if I'm a woman listening right now and I marched and I want to now turn that enthusiasm into some kind of action, what do I do? Where do I go from here?
There's lots to do. First, stay connected to the Women's March and sign up locally for community. There's all kinds of community organizing that's happening at the local level for people to be able to engage in local elections, to learn more about what it looks like to run for office, to get involved on issues that they care about. There's There's actually a list on the Where We Go From Here website. There's all kinds of resources of organizations that are working on a host of issues where people can plug in.
And Abby, what do you think needs to happen to turn the march and the enthusiasm on the part of the demonstrators into a larger movement?
Well, I think it's the same. I mean, I think that, yes, we can all have concerns about Donald Trump, but at the end of the day, at the end of the march, he is still the president. He will continue to be the president, and we have the same political system that we've had for decades that we must learn how to maneuver within. And so I think, you know, empowering women, encouraging women to run for office, encouraging women to work with their legislators to help draft legislation that's important to them, and to be open to working with other groups. I mean, you know, me personally, as someone who worked with Planned Parenthood and is now pro-life, I still work with Planned Parenthood and organizations like NOW on various issues that affect women at the state level. And so I think that we have to be open to working with each other and have to be open to that diversity of thought. And I think that that's going to bring about significant change.
Abby Johnson, founder of the anti-abortion group And Then There Were None, Ai-Jen Poo, director of the National Domestic Workers Alliance. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And we want to hear from you. Did you attend a women's march this weekend? And how do you plan to continue to be involved if you do? Give us a call at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or you can weigh in on our Facebook page at KCRW Press Play. Coming up on the program, so how effective are mass demonstrations in creating lasting change? We're going to look at past marches as a guide next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. As we were just discussing, the big question after the huge marches that took place across the country on Saturday is, where does the movement go from here? To give us some wider historical context for that question, I'm joined now by Todd Gitlin, professor of journalism and sociology at Columbia University. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. So let me quote you, a quote from a writer, Michael White, one of the creators of Occupy Wall Street, who wrote in The Guardian last week, "Without a clear path from march to power, the protest is designed to be an ineffective feel-good spectacle." He's referring to the Women's March. What do you think of that? Is there the danger of this being a one-time feel-good spectacle, or do you think it actually could translate into a lasting movement?
I think the latter, but that depends on a million decisions that people are already beginning to make. I think he's putting it a bit too strongly. I think that the feel-good is an important component of what happens. People have to feel heartened. I feel heartened by the turnout. I feel heartened by the discussions that are going on. And I feel heartened by what one of your guests just said about that what we're in now is a fight for democracy. There are going to be plenty of people who understand what a threat to democracy Donald Trump is. Not just a threat to interests, but to our entire democratic way of life. And we will need to put aside or put on the table our strength, our what bonds us together. And we will have to keep in abeyance some things where we're divided. I also think that with so many people talking about acting locally, I think this cannot but herald a step forward, many steps forward, because as somebody just said, local power is where it's at. You know, the Republican Party, having controlled two-thirds of the states, having come into control of two-thirds of the states over recent years, controls vote suppression, controls redistricting, controls all the medical decisions. There's a lot of catch-up that has to be done. So it may seem like a long step from, oh my God, Donald Trump in the White House, to I'm going to run for city council, or I'm going to work on a program, a common program for city council or state legislature. But, you know, that is where this movement, if it is to be a movement, has to move. It needs power. And I know power has something of a dirty sound. The people on the right, I think, are rather unambivalent about it. They tend to be more authoritarian, if you'll pardon me. Our people are more rambunctious and anarchistic and horizontalist and so on. Power is an indispensable element of political life. It's the oxygen we breathe, and we can't afford to be totally squeamish about it.
And when it comes to that power, doesn't there have to be some kind of focus as to what your goals are?
There does. And that's an argument that needs to be taken place starting yesterday. I have my own ideas where the commonality is. I think that progressive taxation is central. I think that publicly supplied jobs is essential. I think that medical care is essential. I support the Women's March program. Which of those are the core? And what, you know, at some point you have to draw a line, because you can't fight an ideology with a list.
Right.
The ideology that's in power says, you know, government bad, deregulation good, business wonderful. We have a list. We need, you know, again, nobody can pontificate about what this common program ought to be, but there needs to be rather rapid consolidation around a collective story about what's at stake.
And why does or doesn't this story and this tactic and this strategy, why does or doesn't it fall within the Democratic Party's purviews? What does this need to be something that's outside the Democratic political party?
I think it needs to be a caucus within the party. The Democratic Party is a hulk. It's a shell. It's a fundraising apparatus. And it's a presidential selection mechanism. But most places in the country, the Democratic Party doesn't really exist. I mean, how many people who are listening now have ever been to a Democratic Party meeting?
Mm-hmm.
So in some ways that tells us just how hollow the Democratic Party is. But the other thing it tells us is that it's available. It's a field of action. So therefore, it should not be regarded as a monolith enemy. It should be regarded as a vehicle that, rightly or wrongly, exists. And there's no sense in protesting, you know, the fact that there's oxygen in the air. There's no sense protesting the fact that we have, for various constitutional reasons, a two-party system. There's only once in American history has a major party been replaced by another major party, and it took slavery to do it in 1852. It's not going to happen now. So I think progressive caucuses are the way to go. But you know, don't be afraid of the Democratic Party. There's actually not much to it.
Okay. So, you know, let's take a little history lesson from you now and look back at major marches, maybe the March on Washington as a big example of a march that actually did translate into something concrete, and that was the 1964 Civil Rights Act. Have other marches ever come close to that kind of success?
Well, let's be a little more meticulous about the history. So the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom, by the way, most people don't know that it was making economic demands as well, was the culmination of years of activity on the ground in desegregation campaigns in the South, as in Montgomery, Alabama. Lots of voter registration, lots of fights, lots of civil rights workers being murdered by the terror states of the Deep South. Lots of legal help, lots of medical help. The March on Washington was a consolidation of something that was already going. Now we have something of a different order. We have all this simmering feeling, obviously, was ready to be mobilized in shock and horror at the election of you-know-who. But now, in a sense, the order is inverted. It's really, I can't think of another example where a huge demonstration sort of, and in some ways, came out of nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
You know, now comes the time when mobilization needs to be translated into organization. In the past, and this was also true in the anti-war movement, it was the organization that preceded the mobilizations.
Yeah. And so you had all these other marches recently, most notably one that protested the Iraq War back in 2003, I believe. And this was also a worldwide protest. And
yes,
it obviously did not lead to the end of the war?
Well, you see, that was a one shot. It was very clear, I think, to, you know, I was on that march in New York. It was huge. It was very clear to everyone that George Bush was determined to go to war. There was nothing that would stop it. And once the attempt to stop the war had failed, you know, there seemed to be no logical successor move, no next step, no plan B. And, you know, that was, I think, tragic, but doesn't really apply to this situation because the nightmare has already begun. Okay. The barbarians are in the White House. So now we need a different trajectory. It's a long, steady process. There's going to be a 100-day component to it, but it has to be a 1,000-day component and a 2,000-day component, which goes at the deep political roots of this machinery that has turned America inside out.
Todd Gitlin, professor of journalism and sociology at Columbia University, thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
Coming up, LA's persistent homeless problem. Maybe we need some fresh ideas. So today we begin a series of conversations about what LA can learn from other cities.
It's about the fact that we believe in you. You're standing on the corner. We don't see you as a beggar. We see you as a citizen of our community.
How Albuquerque created a jobs program for panhandlers. Next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Powerful rain is battering Southern California, and in this wet weather, the homeless are especially vulnerable. The Midnight Mission shelter on Skid Row housed about a third more people than usual this past weekend. Meanwhile, the LA Fire Department rescued five homeless people from a flooded encampment in the South Bay. One of them was sent to the hospital. Others just battened down in tents on sidewalks throughout the city. Of course, our homeless situation is a year-round crisis, not just when it rains. About 47,000 homeless people live on the streets in and around Los Angeles. Well, throughout this week on Press Play, you'll hear about potential solutions from other parts of the country. Leaders in other cities and states will discuss the creative ways they are tackling homelessness, starting with Albuquerque Mayor Richard Berry. Back in 2015, he saw a homeless panhandler on the street holding up a sign. The sign said, "Want a job," and it gave Berry an idea. He ended up creating a work program for the homeless called There's a Better Way. It's been running for more than a year now and has provided hundreds of jobs to people on the streets. I spoke with Berry about his initiative recently, and I began by asking him to describe that encounter with the panhandler.
I was literally coming back from a lunch like every mayor in America does every day with, can't even remember who the lunch was with at this point, and I saw a panhandler. Had the sign. So the man needs a job. I came back. I told my chief of staff, let's give the man a job. So go down to the motor pool, find an old van. I just make sure it's safe. Get $50,000. Call St. Martin's Hospitality Center. I'm sure LA's full of great nonprofits that do this kind of work.
Mm-hmm.
Ask them if they will take this on with us. Call my, we call it Solid Waste Department, Clean Cities Department, whatever you call it there, and see if there's trash and weeds to pick up, already knowing that there's always trash and weeds to pick up. And see if we can get our city department to work and create opportunities to hire people on day work, $9 an hour. They get lunch. They get the dignity of work for the day. And so we hired St. Martin's to do that. And we have a guy named Will who drives that van, and he's unbelievable.
So what does he do? He goes around the city, sees people who are panhandling, stops the van and says, do you want to work today?
Would you like to get off the corner today? But it's more than that. It's more than day labor. In fact, day labor is not even what it's about. It's about the fact that we believe in you. You're standing on the corner. We don't see you as a beggar. We see you as a citizen of our community. This is your town, too. Would you like your town to look nicer? We would. We would like to give you a job for the day. We believe you can do a good job. So we're going to hire you. Now we've cleaned up 310 or 355 city blocks. Now we've picked up over 100,000 pounds of trash and weeds. And if you know how much a tumbleweed weighs, that's a lot of tumbleweeds. And we have given 1,500 day jobs so far. But what we've really done is we've given these people an opportunity. And at the end of the day, when you're counting cash out in their hand, they're feeling good about themselves. Nobody's believed in them for a long time, maybe, or if ever. And then you ask them, hey, listen, there's a reason you're on the corner. Would you like to invest in yourself today? We have substance abuse programs, mental health programs, housing programs. Can we get you to make that investment in yourself and see if we can get you on a better path? And gosh, people jump at it.
So how many people have participated in this program since you started?
About 1,500 people so far. Uh-huh. We started as a pilot program. That's what we do in government when we're not sure something's going to work. We call it a pilot program so that if it doesn't work, we can move on. But this is, it's working. And so we've added more resources to our city budget to do this. Heck of a value for the taxpayer. City looks better. You know, we have a beautiful city, mountain states, you know, high desert climate here, mountains, you know, you can golf in the morning or ski in the morning, golf in the afternoon here. It's a great place, but it's even better now. And we've put about 150 clients in substance abuse full time. We've had 13,000 people call into the, we put these signs up to initially that said, if you need food or shelter, call 311. We'll get you connected with that. That was kind of an early phase of the program. We've had 13,000 people call in, or 13,000 times people have called in. Because a lot of our panhandlers, we live on an interstate, some are traveling through. They don't know what services are available here. So, yeah, it's really getting up there and who's being affected. And then we did run across in this process 20 chronically homeless people. They would be people that would be similar to the Los Angeles. In fact, part of my learning process of this early on was Project 50 out of L.A. I was coming back from Los Angeles on a mayoral trip, and I read the L.A. Times, and there was an article, I think, called Promises Kept, and it was about Project 50 and the struggles the program had seen, where they took 50 people in L.A., tried to calculate the cost to the system of, you know, struggling for survival on the streets, this idea that the chronically homeless are in crisis so much that the public spends a lot of resources trying to help them survive, and it would be less expensive to put them into housing. So mm-hmm. that was an early impetus of this. So this program has not been expensive. It has made a real difference in people's lives. It's made our city look better. And I think it really just speaks to a different way of dealing with people that are in crisis, rather than just, you know, when you hand $5 out the window, I know it feels good, but if you have an honest conversation with panhandlers, many of them are addicts. They're going to spend your $5 buying drugs or alcohol. Maybe they get a fast food meal. But if that $5 could feed them 7 days next week through a nonprofit, or a food bank can feed 20 people with that $5, we can really make a difference in people's lives.
So you pay them $9 an hour. So about...
We only work about 5 hours.
But, okay, so you're giving them around $50.
$50.
45. Okay, 50
about
bucks. In cash. And are you mm-hmm. afraid that they'll take that money and just go buy drugs or alcohol?
Well, they can do whatever they want with the money. What we see a lot of them doing, they'll actually team up. If they're not qualified for a housing program, we see a lot of them team up, and they'll get hotel rooms for the night or for the week. It's amazing when you start having some resources and you've never had them and you're living, you know, hand to mouth, you will actually... I think we're wired to make better decisions when you have that. We have not had any stories so far where people have done that. And frankly, $50, making $50 pulling weeds and picking up trash in the day, these panhandlers, some of them make a lot more than that just standing on the corner. So the people that tend to take this opportunity aren't the scammers. Mm. And there are a few scammers out there, right? The people that take this are the ones that really find themselves in a position where they really want to do something better. And that's why I call it Better Way. You know, there's a better way than standing on the corner asking for money. There's a better way than handing $5 out your window. There's a better way than giving somebody a ticket, a misdemeanor for standing on the corner. In fact, with a recent Supreme Court decision out of, I think, Gilbert, Arizona, a lot of these cities that have prohibitions are going to find those overturned anyway. So let's get busy and be smart about this thing. You know, you can have a big heart and be a good fiscal steward at the same time, and try to give these people a chance.
So you're a city of about 600,000. LA yes. is a city of about 4 million. In the city proper, 28,000 are homeless. Is this something that can be done in a big city like Los Angeles?
I think it's scalable. I think it's scalable up and down. I think you do this in a town of 500 people, And I think you could do this in L.A. or Boston or New York or Chicago. In fact, Rahm Emanuel called a couple of weeks ago to tell me he's starting to do this in Chicago. I know Mayor Hancock's doing it in Denver. Mayor Rawlings, I think they're putting some money in their budget in Dallas. Mayor Reed, Kasim Reed in Atlanta, I think is looking at this as well. If not already, they sent a team out to talk to our folks about it. So I think it is a simple enough program to where it can be scaled. And I think different cities can do different things. There's never a shortage of things to do in a community. It wouldn't have to be weeds and litter. It could be other things. It could be painting. It could be graffiti covering. It could be, you know, you name it.
Well, Mayor Barry, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Thanks for the chance to do that.
Richard Barry, Mayor of Albuquerque, New Mexico. Coming up on this program, there's a measles outbreak in Los Angeles among the Orthodox Jewish community, despite California's strict vaccination law. How that law's loopholes may undermine its purpose, next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. 20 measles cases have been recently confirmed in Southern California. This latest outbreak of the virus comes just 6 months after the state's tough vaccination law went into effect. Most of the people diagnosed with the disease are part of LA's Orthodox Jewish community. None of those diagnosed in LA County had been vaccinated. So for more on this latest outbreak, Dr. Jeffrey Gunzenhauer joins me now. He's the interim health officer for Los Angeles County. Welcome back to the program.
Glad to be here.
So you're investigating 18 of those 20 cases because those were the ones in the county. Most of those people diagnosed, they knew each other?
Yes, that's correct. Most of the individuals come from a small social group. They're either friends or relatives in a small chain, and it affects 16 of the 18 cases here in Los Angeles County are from that small social group.
And this is within an Orthodox Jewish community?
I can't confirm exactly what the group is, but it is one small social group.
Right. Okay. So remind us how contagious measles is, and so how many people could have been exposed?
Measles is one of the most contagious diseases that we know. It's estimated that if you bring one individual into a group, let's say there's 10 people there and none of them has been vaccinated, 9 out of the 10 are likely to come down with the illness. It's very infectious. In this particular outbreak, with just 18 cases, we've identified over 2,200 contacts. And so as a result of that, we go out to each of those contacts, verify that they've been exposed, check to see if they've been vaccinated. If not, we try to protect them, or we may even isolate them to protect others.
And are they contagious if they have no symptoms?
Yes. Measles, there's a prodrome before the rash. The most characteristic feature of measles is a rash, which begins on the face and can affect the whole body. But for 3 or 4 days before that, they can feel ill, they can have a fever or sore throat, perhaps some red eyes, but they may not realize that they're contagious, and during that period, they can affect others.
So of those 2,200 people that you're investigating, how many of those could possibly have it and have spread it to others?
Out of the 2,200 that we investigated, less than 10% had not been vaccinated. It was less than 200. So we had about 150 to 200 persons. We offered prophylaxis to over 50 of those. If you catch it early in their exposure, we can give them the vaccine, we can give them immune globulin, and that may protect them. Then if they're not protected, we follow them up to 21 days because they could still develop the measles, and we basically quarantine them, ask them to restrict voluntarily their activities during that period so they wouldn't affect others.
So you've quarantined those 150 to 200 people?
All of those people have voluntarily agreed to restrict their activities. I do have authority as the health officer, if I need to legally order people to do that, to strongly request it, but people have voluntarily cooperated with our requests.
What does that look like? Do they not leave their homes?
That's right. So if they would normally be going to school, we'd say, please don't go to school. If they would normally be going to work, we'd say, don't go to work. If they're going to go to some large social thing, like to a basketball game, to a theme park or something, we would say, please don't do that. Restrict your activity. Stay at home. You might be with some other people. Monitor your symptoms. If you become ill, let us know.
Wow. So are you afraid that this will cause a large outbreak?
Right now, it looks like there's some hope we're near the end.
Uh-huh.
We can't say that for sure. The first case occurred in the first couple of days, December. There were 16 cases in the last 3 weeks up to the beginning of the new year. And in the last 20 days or so, we've only had one additional case. So we may see some additional cases in the next few days, but it's possible there will be none or a few, and we hope that the outbreak will be over in another 6 weeks or so.
And how many of these who had measles in this latest outbreak, how many of them are children?
Quite a few of them are children. A lot of children who did not get vaccinated when they went into sixth grade are still in public schools. The majority of the cases are either older children or young adults.
So they wouldn't have been affected by the new law?
That is correct.
Well, let's talk about that, because this requires that children provide proof they've been vaccinated before they enter kindergarten and before they enter the seventh grade.
Yes, that's correct. What the law actually says is that any new child entering the school system has to provide proof. So usually that would be kindergarten or first grade, or if they moved in from another state and are entering fourth grade, they'd have to provide that documentation. So the first time they enter California school system, and then there's a mandatory recheck when they go into seventh grade.
So if you were in first grade when this law went into effect, you wouldn't have to get a vaccination until seventh grade.
That's correct.
So, and same after in high school, right?
That's exactly. Once you get through seventh grade, there may be no place anywhere, unless you go into healthcare or something else where they would require you to have the vaccination, perhaps, where they would ever be checked again.
So there are many children who potentially won't get vaccinated.
That's exactly right. What we know in California today, there are many older children in high school, many young adults who've either had no vaccination or one vaccine. And so when we get a case introduced into the county, there's a chance that it can get spread. And there are certain groups where they feel strongly against vaccination, even though the science is strongly on the side of vaccination, strongly shows it's safe, strongly shows it's effective. There are people who choose not to get vaccinated. What I would recommend to people, even though they may be beyond this, if they should really think about getting vaccinated. So the next time they see their provider, they should say, I want to make sure I'm protected against measles. Can you please check my vaccination record? If it's not up to date, please vaccinate me.
Is there any danger of being over-vaccinated?
There's no danger. There have been many studies that have looked at claims that there's too many antigens or too many immunizations, and there's been no evidence to say that that is harmful.
Okay, so even if, let's say, you forgot and you don't have the records, you should just get one just in case?
What a physician or a provider would probably do is a blood test first. Because if it shows that you've got antibody, you've either had the disease or you were vaccinated, the blood test would show that, and then you wouldn't need the vaccine. That's often what they'll do.
Right. And so do you see this as a big public health problem, that there's a cadre of young adults who are unvaccinated and are unlikely to get vaccinated?
Yes, I do see this as a public health problem. One of the features that's underappreciated is the fact that individuals born before 1957 probably had measles as a child. So they're all immune. So everybody who's 60 or older in the county right now had measles as a child. What I'm concerned about is the population ages, and suddenly people who are in their 50s now are then in their 60s or older. Those people who were never vaccinated and then they develop measles when they're older with chronic diseases, they're probably at severe risk of having a bad outcome, getting hospitalized, having encephalitis or pneumonia or worse. So I do see that as the population ages and this proportion of people that aren't vaccinated become older, we're going to see more and more serious consequences from these outbreaks.
And how dangerous is it for children?
Measles, generally, for children, the risk of a very serious complication is very low. The overall risk of death from measles is about 1 in 1,000. It's lower than that for children. But if you're older or if you're very young, let's say you're less than a year old, you're an infant, you haven't received, can't receive the vaccine, they're very much at risk because they're not protected. So the very young, the very old, and people of any type of chronic health condition are at risk of serious health consequences.
So it's more of a risk for passing it on to people who are vulnerable.
That's exactly right. And the way to think of this is if I get vaccinated, I'm protecting others.
All right. Dr. Jeffrey Gunzenhauser, Interim Health Officer for Los Angeles County. Thanks for joining us.
You're quite welcome. Thank you very much.
And Julie Myers is here now with the listener feedback. Hello.
The case of the Jeezles.
Nope. Just going to nope you right there. Don't think so.
I took a chance, Madeline.
I don't want that to be communicable, so let's end it.
We talked about the Women's March for the first half of the show, and we talked about what's next. And Bonnie Burkert sent us a message on Facebook. She says, hello, the march in downtown LA was peaceful. Everyone was kind to each other, and it was great to see the creativity in messaging. And she says that it's time to do it again. It's time to start planning again. She says, April 22nd, Earth Day. Let's make a plan of it. Help spread the word. And we had a lot of other people who said after the march, write to your senators, write to your lawmakers, keep it going.
All right. Thank you, Julie Myers. We're going to stop it going right now with you at least.
That's right.
And in this program, I'm Madeline Brand. Thank you so much for listening. I will see you tomorrow.